Why is it called a love song? The love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. I can just start you with that question. Why is it a love song? I'd also like to start you with a few other poems, to measure the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock with. First, a quote from Turnier. We know that there are overwhelming questions in this poem. If you don't take the time to look for answers when a big question finds you, then you not only don't have answers, you lose the ability to recognize even the important questions that give life meaning. You live in a twilight world. End of.
John, say that again.
If you don't take the time to look for answers when a big question finds you, then you not only don't have answers, you lose the ability to recognize even the important questions that give life meaning. You live in a twilight world. And it's been said that the book of Job, I just reminded now, the book of Job is a list of the questions worthy of a man or a woman. An interesting thing. In Job, yeah. And if you read the New Jerusalem Bible, you can get the it's translated by Tolkien, the guy who wrote The Lord of the Rings.
What book of Job is the translator?
In the New Jerusalem Bible, Tolkien was the translator of Job. You know that I think I mentioned when I read this poem at supper or at lunch, that the question that was put to the man in the Inferno in the epigraph was, "Who art thou? Who art thou?" And then the poem begins, "Let us go then, you and I." In a sense, in an answer to that question. One of the most important "Who art thou's," I think, in the Bible is, well, there are lots of them, some with Jesus, but when Jacob wrestles with the angel. And I think that is a wrestling to answer the question, "Who art thou?" And how does that spiritual combat help us understand the answering of that question in the Prufrock poem? Remember that Jacob wrestled, and there was one who wrestled with him until daybreak, who, seeing that he could not master him, struck him in the socket of his hip, and Jacob's hip was dislocated as he wrestled with him. Still Jacob wouldn't let him go. He said, "Let me go, for today is breaking," says God. But Jacob answered, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." Then he then asks, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he replied. He said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have been strong against God." Strong against God. Marvelous paradox. Blessed for being strong against God. "You shall prevail against men. Because you have been strong against God, you shall prevail against men." Jacob then made this request, "I beg you, who art thou? Tell me who you are." But the fellow he was wrestling with said, "Why do you ask my name?" And he blessed him there. So there is a spiritual combat that may help us in talking about and thinking about Prufrock, another kind of combat. The love song of J. Alfred Prufrock is, in some senses, a lamentation. It's a lamentation. It's a sad poem, isn't it? Well, let's hear a lamentation. What is the help us measure the love song, this poem? This lamentation comes from Jeremiah. "You have seduced me, Yahweh, and I have let myself be seduced. You have overpowered me. You were the stronger. I am a daily laughingstock, everybody's butt. Each time I speak the word, I have to howl and proclaim violence and ruin. The word of Yahweh is meant for me insult, derision all day long. I used to say I will not think about him. I will not speak in his name anymore. Then there seemed to be a fire burning in my heart, imprisoned in my bone. The effort to restrain it wearied me. I could not bear it. I hear so many disparaging me, terror from every side. Denounce him. Let us denounce him. All those who used to be my friends watched for my downfall. Perhaps he will be seduced into error, and then we will master him and take our revenge. But Yahweh is at my side, a mighty hero. My opponents will stumble, mastered, confounded by their failure. Everlasting, unforgettable disgrace will be theirs. But you, Yahweh Sabaoth, you who probe with justice, who scrutinize the loins and heart, let me see the vengeance you will take on them, for I have committed my cause to you. Sing to Yahweh, praise Yahweh, for he has delivered the soul of the needy from the hands of evil men. And one of the most magnificent changes in tone of voice in the whole Bible, he goes on, from sing to Yahweh, praise Yahweh, for he has delivered the soul of the needy from the hands of evil men. A curse on the day I was born. No blessing on the day my mother bore me. A curse on the man who brought my father the news. A son, a baby, has been born to you, making him overjoyed. May this man be like the towns that Yahweh overthrew without mercy. May he hear alarms in the morning, the war cry in broad daylight. Since he did not kill me in the womb, my mother would have been my tomb while her womb was swollen with me. Why did I come out of the womb to live in toil and sorrow and to end my days in shame? And that's a lamentation. How does that measure the lamentation of Prufrock? That's from Jeremiah 20, verse 7 through 18. This poem is a love song. So I'll read you a love song written by John Milton's secretary, or assistant, Andrew Marvel, back in 16, probably around 1660, maybe. This fellow was a quiet tutor a tutor with a T-U-T, before he was John Milton's secretary, assistant, during the Reformation. This is a love song. And those of you who have read the poem, listen for the phrases that are from this poem that are in Prufrock. This is called To His Coy Mistress. To His Coy Mistress. The fellow is talking to his lady. Had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. We would sit down and think which way to walk and pass our long love's day. Thou by the Indian Ganges side should rubies find, I by the tide of Himber would complain. I would love you 10 years before the flood, and you should, if you please, refuse till the conversion of the Jews. My vegetable love should grow vaster than empires and more slow. 100 years should go to praise thine eyes, and on thy forehead gaze, 200 to adore each breast, but 30,000 to the rest, an age at least to every part, and the last age should know your heart. For, lady, you deserve this state, nor would I love at lower rate. But at my back I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near, and yonder all before us lie deserts of vast eternity. Thy beauty shall no more be found, nor in thy marble vault shall sound my echoing song. Then worms shall try that long preserved virginity, and your quaint honor turn to dust, and into ashes all my lust. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. Now therefore, while the youthful hue sits on thy skin like morning dew, and while thy willing soul transpires at every pore with instant fires, now let us sport us while we may, and now, like amorous birds of prey, rather at once our time devour than languish in this slow-chapped power. Let us roll all our strength and all our sweetness up into one ball, and tear our pleasures with rough strife through the iron gates of life. Thus, though we cannot make our son stand still, yet we will make him run. Alexa, love. 50 years before Prufrock, Eliot wrote this poem. A poem was written called Dover Beach by a fellow named Matthew Arnold. And it came 3 centuries after man found out that the Earth was no longer the center of the universe. It came about the time that Darwin found out that rather than being parochial or patronizing to animals, we were supposedly an extension of the animals. That shook many people. Some new discoveries in textual, well, what would you say? Textual criticism, I suppose, frightened many people, as it started to seem like there were discrepancies, more discrepancies in the Bible than before. And faith, the faith that was the coherence of the Middle Ages, was sort of dealt a shattering blow in the mid-19th century. And this poem is written, and I'll read it, because in some ways the poem is about inability to love and also lack of faith. Dover Beach. You know where Dover Beach is? England? White Cliffs of Dover, you know? Across the way is France, is not that far, I believe. Is that right? You're Anglophile in the room, Nancy? Is that right? It's just not very far away at all. The scene is the, say, Matthew Arnold talking to his love. Dover Beach. The sea is calm tonight. The tide is full. The moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast, the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand glimmering and vast out in the tranquil bay. Come to the window. Sweet is the night air. Only from the long line of spray where the sea meets the moon-blanched sand, listen, you hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves draw back and fling at their return up the high strand. Begin and cease, and then again begin, with tremulous cadence slow, and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Sophocles long ago heard it on the Aegean, and it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in the sound a thought, hearing it by this distant northern sea. The sea of faith was once, too, at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled, but now I only hear its melancholy long withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges drear and naked shingles of the world. Ah, love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy nor love, nor light nor certitude, nor peace nor help for pain, and we are here as on the darkling plain swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. Ah, love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And the hope is seen in the love. Then 50 years later, when in this Eliot poem, what has become of the hope? Because certainly in Prufrock, there's neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. Well, I was going to read it again, but I don't think read the poem again. But,
did Eliot write this poem?
Which?
The one we're talking about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who's J. Alfred
Prufrock? He's the speaker of the poem. Like, in a poem you have what's called a persona, and that's the guy who says the poem. And that isn't always the guy who wrote the poem. Many times it isn't the guy who wrote the poem.
But that's kind of one of the context this is written. I mean, like what you wrote from Dante's Inferno this afternoon.
Uh-huh. The context for that?
Yes, is that the context? I mean, are we reading about a man in hell?
Well, Eliot wrote that.
Eliot wrote that.
Yeah, Eliot wrote the title to the poem. And we make a distinction between voices. Now, Eliot wrote the title of the poem. And Prufrock, in a sense, Eliot overheard the speech that this poem is. And Prufrock said it. And one of the definitions of poetry is overheard speech that never really happened. Right? That's a nice definition of a poem sometimes. Overheard speech which never really happened. And in a sense, think of Eliot being in the next room, like in Koinonia where the walls are so thin. And he hears Prufrock say this. He writes it down and then titles it The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock and puts the epigraph from Dante's Inferno at the beginning. That's the way to look at who wrote this poem, you know, or what the voices of the poem. You heard Tom say the other day that modern poetry began with the third line of this poem. The third line of this poem, says John Berryman, is the beginning of modern poetry. Now, there are people who will disagree with that, but why would he say that? Why would Berryman say that? The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. Let us go then, you and I, while the evening is spread out against the sky, like a patient etherized upon the table. It's sort of a double take, isn't it? It pulls us back from our expectation of the normal love song. Would continue from those first two lines, wouldn't it? In a completely different way. And it just slams us back. What? I'm trying to be quiet tonight. I've got about 10 hours of tapes in the library of times when I've been talking. But what? How does the poem, you know, why is it a love song? Why is it called a love song? I think it's a self-love kind of thing. Would that be a... Does Prufrock know that? You'd say that Eliot heard this going on in the next room and then said, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. Yeah. Isn't this ironic? Isn't it ironic that it's self-love? John Berryman has it that the Prufrock, let us go then, you and I, the visit is to ask a lady for her hand in marriage, to make a proposal. The overwhelming question, will you marry me? That is an interpretation or part of an interpretation. It is not the only one. It's not one that I feel as comfortable with as some other ones. But it is one that Berryman came up with. And there is support for that interpretation in the poem. But
if you overheard Prufrock's speech and then thought, considered it prophetic, then you could call it a love song. Just in the prophecy you could get.
Mm-hmm. Of what's prophetic as to what's happened to love?
Oh, I don't think I was thinking that.
Or what?
It's maybe more what's happened to life, or what the dilemma of man is, or where we all are, kind of thing. And if he was overhearing it through the walls, he could title it that just because the reason he would write it down and give it to the world would be kind of a love song.
I have a question about beginning. I don't know if this is Italian or what, but what is it?
Yeah, it's Italian, and it's written by Dante, and it, the fellow who says that is in hell, and he's there. Dante, you know, is going through hell meeting all these people and asking them, you know, who art thou, and so forth. And this particular fellow is a flame, like a flame. And he was on this earth. He says, I was a rake, and then I got old, and then I decided that it was seemly to become a monk, and he became a monk. And then the Pope asked him for counsel. And the fellow who speaks here, Guido, I think is his name, says, well, if I give you the best counsel, I will be sinning. And the Pope has asked him to give him counsel. And he says, if I can be absolved of this sin before I do it, I will give you this counsel. And then the Pope at that time says, consider it done. You know, those old popes at that time were really something else. Consider it done. And so he said, promise much but give little. That was his, you know, promise the people much but give little. And he went to hell, and for that, for trying to seek absolution before he did a sin. And going ahead and sinning, and expecting to be absolved of a sin not yet done. And then he went ahead and did the sin, and then he went to hell. And one of the interesting things is that St. Francis meets him. St. Francis meets him after he dies, and St. Francis is sort of the keeper here, and he says, you know, you forgot something, Guido. He says, before I was a saint, I was a teacher of rhetoric. and then he said, you know, you can't have absolution without contrition. You cannot have absolution without contrition for a sin that you're then going to do. There's a contradiction there, and so go to hell. And he gets him down to hell. That's all that happens. And
this is in Dante's Inferno.
And this is what Guido, when Prufrock says, "What are you know?" Or when Dante asks that, "Who art thou?" Then he says, "Well, I wouldn't tell you if I thought you'd ever escape hell. But since no man has ever been to hell and then gone back to earth, and then I don't have anything, you can't shame me if I tell you my story. And so I'll tell you my story." And then he goes and tells you the story that I told you. He says a few other interesting things. One is that he says that, don't worry, you stand there, the guy, Guido says, don't worry, you stand there looking so worried. He says, I'm aflame, but it irks me not. I mean, I'm in hell, but it irks me not. It doesn't bother me. Do you want to look at the you on this poem? Let us go then, you and I. Who is the you? You and I. Who are they? I mean, would it help to think of that as do you think it's a lady that he's talking to? Is it the reader that he's talking to? Is it Eliot that he's talking to? Prufrock, maybe he knows he's over there. Eliot has said this, or would you say it could be two parts of the same person? Internal dialogue? Well, let's go. I mean, if I was sitting with a person then to go, I'd say, well, let's go. But is there a difference when you say, let's go then? Well, let us go then, you and I. I think probably the best way to look at this you and I, the primary way to look at it in terms of what Prufrock means when he says it, is he's having an internal dialogue. Let's go then, you and I, and go out. Now, what does Eliot mean by allowing that to be said? He means that. I think he can also mean you, the reader. And Prufrock is going to show you his world. Rather than answer the question, who he is, he's going to show you his world. Rather than to tell, he's going to show, which is good poetic sense, to show, not tell. Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. What kind of a man looks up at the sky and says it's like a patient etherized upon a table? Does he think an operation is going to be taking place, some major surgery is right around the corner for him? It's an example of projection, isn't it? I mean, you're in your inner state and then you project it out, your outer state. What you see becomes the way you're feeling inside. he's going to be sprawled, you know, pinned in a few stanzas. It's twilight time of the year, twilight time. The evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights and one-night cheap hotels. The muttering retreats. Well, I don't want to do this. I don't want to talk about every line. I've already done this. You know, don't want to go through this. What questions do you have about the poem? Poetry is called by Archibald MacLeish a trap for meditation. Long and continuous. And that's something that this is. And if you feel like a dummy, know that you feel like I do when I read this poem, and I certainly when I read it the first, you know, half dozen times, I felt like a dummy. One thing that it's good to know is that one of the reasons this is a modern poem is that Eliot had certain novelties about his poetry. He left out the transitions. He didn't give you any transitions. He just goes from one thing to the next. From the epigraph to let us go then you and I while evening is spread out against the sky. And then he goes on to the next. And then all of a sudden you've got this overwhelming question of insidious intent, you know, happening, or the streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent. To lead you to an overwhelming question, the odor don't ask, but is it, let's go and make our visit. In the room, the women come and go talking of Michelangelo. How did that get in there? You know. Why is he talking about that? That's part of his style, the novelty of his style, and one of the reasons why I think why it took 7 years to get this poem published. Because it shocked everybody when it came out. Another thing is that the meaning of the poem is not given in a sort of a step-by-step way, coherent way. But Eliot was writing the poem, he'd introduce themes and leave them, and then introduce them again and leave them, and introduce them and leave them, and he wanted the whole poem itself to carry all the meaning of the poem, rather than the meaning coming in this line and then developed and so forth. He gives the whole texture of the thing, and then you get the sense of the poem, from the whole, rather than just the single part. And one other thing that's new with Eliot is that he has literature talking to itself. He writes poems that talk to other poems. There is a conversation going on between this poem and Dante's Inferno. Many other poems. History, Michelangelo, introduced and dropped. The Yellow Fog That Rubs Its Backs, Images Poetry, Carl Sandburg, The Fog Comes on Little Cat Feet. That was written 4 years before this poem. He develops Carl Sandburg's sweet little poem that most of us know. You know, Fog Comes on Little Cat Feet overlooking the harbor and the city. It does something and then is gone. It moves or something and then is gone. Here's the fog. He's talking to other poems. Elise, do you have any advice here?
Advice?
Advice?
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't... all those things that you're really prepared for, and thinking, oh yeah, now I'm going to see outside the section of the sky.
He keeps surprising us with ugly, ugly, not just arbitrary ugliness, but very meaningful ugliness, in a sense. Let's go than you and I, and first you say, I don't know what he's talking about, and then you say, I do too know what he's talking about. I know those evenings. Mm-hmm. But how can I know those evenings? Because, darn it, I mean, how was he able to capture something that I've seen that I would never in a million years consciously know that I've seen? I would never in a word association test come up with, you know, oh, the evening. Like a patient etherized upon a patient. And yet when he says it, I know what he means. I know what he means. And the sense of... Let's go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights and one-night cheap hotels. To talk about going to a whorehouse as a muttering retreat is a wonderful way to talk about it. A muttering retreat. Is this whole poem a muttering retreat? He is. Questions just continues through here in many different kinds. Oh, don't ask what is it, you know. Mm-hmm. But the question keeps coming up. There are questions dropping on plates. There are overwhelming questions. There, he seems to think he has something to say that will disturb the universe.
This is in the epigraph. Dante is talking to us, fearful of the world's judgment. He seems to be fearful of the question.
He's fearful of the questions. Mm-hmm. That's good. And fearful of the world's judgment, too, isn't he?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know? Fearful of the question.
Identify something modern about anxiety. I know that that has been running a lot of statements about modern anxiety. Mm-hmm. One way to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, anxiety degree or that whole, it seems like an anxious. Anxious and also guilty, in a sense, but the way you feel when you, because that question keeps coming up, even though he's, it's like he can't control it. It's like when you're guilty about something and you keep hearing people talk to what you're guilty about, and they aren't talking about it, but you hear it that way.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like that whole, when you don't address something directly, you can't confront something, it breeds anxiety and
It does an interesting anxiety, the two words anguish and anxiety, and I get them mixed up in my head, but one means comes from the root to choke and the other one comes to suffocate, like in drowning.
John?
Yeah.
This is off the whole, but sometimes I find it helpful and necessary almost to understand a little bit about the poet.
Uh-huh.
I guess I don't really know much about the background of T.S. Eliot, you know, just what kind of upbringing he had, maybe just exactly what was happening, maybe, I don't know if you've read up on his life, to just help me see how this poem came about.
Well, he's 22 years old when he wrote it. He's born in St. Louis. His family, I think his dad had something with a company that made bricks, I think, as I remember. His mother was quite religious. He went to Harvard, was an ace student, left Harvard, got very interested in poetry there, left Harvard, left the field of philosophy to go to England, be a poet. Family didn't like that at all, because he was one of the most promising philosophers, and yet he wanted to be, going to be air professor there in philosophy, but he decided to be poetry was what he wanted to do. He went to England, he was a clerk, I believe, in a bank for many, many, many years. And I think while he was writing these poems, this, Wasteland, and so forth, he was a clerk in a bank, I believe. He was very interested in the symbolist poets. There's a guy named Laforgue who wrote poems of fragile lamentation. They weren't as great as Eliot's, but they were talking about modern sadness with real eloquent language. And that was one of the influences on this particular poem, is to talk about modern sadness with some real eloquence. But then one thing he does, he gets the muttering retreats and oyster shells and so forth. That's another reason why he didn't get it published, because he was putting language in very strange places. Butt ends of my days and wills. My life is like an ashtray. Wait a minute. Poetry can't be about subjects like that. It isn't as, it's eloquent. It speaks very well, but it's not with, it's not writing crude poems about crude people. It's writing crude poems about middle class, folks. It's urban. Very clearly, this is a town poem, isn't it? He's known as one of the writers of the average suffering, one of the great writers of average suffering. Not the heroes, Hamlet's suffering, but average suffering.
He wrote this poem on his own?
I think so.
What year did he write it?
He wrote it in 10, it was published in 17. He was really young when he wrote it.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, what year?
1910.
Oh, 1910.
Published in 1917.
Oh.
In this country, I believe this was published in this, well, Poetry Chicago, a magazine now called Poetry, published this poem back in 1917. Amy Lowell was in charge of that at the time. This is very shocking to her, this poem. To everyone.
Now, was this the first one he had
published? No, he had written other poems, published poems in his college days and so forth.
But he wasn't really well known?
No, he wasn't.
In the literary world?
No, no, not in the world scene. Mm. This thing made people sort of perk up their ears, and when Wasteland came out, it just, you know, everybody knew. But they argued with that poem for the same reason they argued with this one. They couldn't understand it. And he was accepted, I think, finally he was accepted because he wrote such beautiful literary criticism. They said, the guy's got to have a reason for doing what he's doing because his literary criticism is so sharp. You know, because he became one of the great young literary critics. Then they said, well, gee, we can't just say he's a barbarian anymore. So they had to look at his poems again.
You said that he was really good friends with which poet?
Ezra Pound. Pound.
Was he influenced a lot by Pound's writings or any other poet?
Not so much. Not so much. He's the real original. Pound, though, edited The Wasteland. If he hadn't, I don't know if Wasteland would have ever made it as a great poem. And then when we do Wasteland next week, I'll talk about some of the stuff that Pound cut out of Wasteland. The first section was rotten. It's just terrible.
Was he married at the time?
I don't know if he was married at this time. He did marry twice.
The reason I asked is when I had a class in British literature once, it really helped me to see just the time period the poets would come out of, what was happening. Whole country
and how
they
really reflected, mm-hmm. not only their own personal life, but what was happening in the world, scenes, or what, you know, mm-hmm. reflecting the whole mood of the time, history of their living in. Yeah.
Really,
one of the strange things about this poem is that it was written 68 years ago. This could have been written yesterday. There's nothing in this poem that makes it not, couldn't it? The irony is that Wasteland was written after World War I.
You can already have a whole hard lifetime, you know, despair or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was very brilliant, and he was very well read, and he read very well. I mean, if you read Hamlet pretty well, you've got a lot of this, don't you? He wanted to, Lewis. This is getting off the phone, but there's a good story about this, because he and Auden wanted to get in with the Inklings, and Auden went, Elliot went to meet Lewis, really liked him and wanted to meet Lewis, and when he met Lewis, he was shocked because he expected a much younger man, and he says, oh, you're much older than I thought, which Lewis just, his vanity just went, you know. Oh, well, and they had one ice-cold conversation. And it was all over for Elliot blew it. Maybe Lewis blew it. I don't know. But anyway, both Auden and Elliot were sort of fellow travelers with the Inklings, but they weren't a part of the group. But they wanted really into it.
Something else that strikes me is the possibility that the time that this is written. Written
before World War
One, but World War One, but it was isn't that also about the time that advertising really started
to take on
great
guns,
the power of advertising?
Mm-hmm.
And
what?
Images? Having an image?
Having an image?
Yeah.
You mean like a personage? You mean like a face?
Well, okay. Personages, or, you know, the good housewife.
Or playing a role?
Well, I think that's Victorian.
What?
I think the decorum that carried over from the pre-Victorian, you know, before Romanticism, and then it was coming back in the Victorian period, where you were supposed to look like a morning coat, my collar mounting firmly to the chin, and so forth, to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. I mean, the personage idea, the role, was very, very, very much in mind in society. This is not, this is in middle, upper middle class people that this poem is written about. Behrman has an interesting thing on that. He says, this is a tragedy, but Prufrock isn't even the hero of his own tragedy, because he's not together enough to even be a hero of his own tragedy, because we don't know him. He doesn't know himself well enough. Isn't that an interesting thought? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nancy.
Oh, I was like, too, it makes me really angry with the poem, and I'm full time with myself, too.
Yeah.
But ever since I first read it, it just makes me so mad. He says, let us go then, you and I. He doesn't go anywhere at all.
Yeah. He doesn't go anywhere.
The whole thing stands still. He doesn't matter retreat, he doesn't matter forward either. It just stands still.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't move, yeah, that's a question. I mean, you've given the answer. He doesn't go anywhere. This is all taking place, sitting there. Let's go, and he never goes. He never goes anywhere. He thinks about it. It has a dreamlike structure, or dreamlike logic. He skips and jumps, and he's daydreaming.
Nightmaring,
daydreaming. It irks him not, though, in terms of a nightmare.
What is it that he...
Daring.
Is it, you know, telling the world that we're all in hell, or what is he?
Is that what it is?
I don't know.
Is it? You know, we're led to an overwhelming question. Don't ask what it is. But still, we can try to ask what that question is. Do I dare do what? Do I dare disturb the universe? How will he disturb the universe?
He won't even disturb himself.
Hmm. Yeah, he won't disturb himself. So how can he? How can he disturb the universe?
He would disturb by disturbing himself.
Yeah.
Like his universe.
If he allowed himself to be, is allowing yourself to be disturbed prerequisite for disturbing the universe?
In a sense, I think it would be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you make the statement, I should have been a paragraph crawler. Right across, covering across the floor of the sea.
Yeah.
So it's like saying, I wish I was in a position where I didn't have to ask these kind of questions about myself.
Yeah.
Because when I ask these questions, I shake everything up.
Yeah.
You know?
I shake my universe up.
Right.
And I want to shake another universe up. Let's look at that part. It's around 35. I think we can talk about. Well, at the whole time's mentioned, I think, seven or eight times in that preceding stanza. There's time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. There will be time to murder and create. Time to drop a question on your plate. Time for you and time for me and time for 100 indecisions. 100 indecisions. The sense that normally when we say we have time, there'll be time to have fun, have a meaningful life, and so forth. Here it's time for indecisions. For visions. And revision. That's one of the great plays on words of all time, provisions and revisions, before the taking of a toast and tea. He says, do I dare disturb the universe? He's locked in his questions. In a minute there's time for decisions and revisions, which a minute will reverse. He wants to, I think Prufrock wants to disturb a universe that's outside himself. Outside himself. He wants to tell the universe that he lives in, the drawing room reality, the tea and crumpets reality, the drinking coffee and chatting reality, the life of consuming ideas rather than having any, where we become consumers of ideas, but we don't really have any in ourselves. We have ideas, but we have no active mind, life of the intellect, so forth. This starts to sort of become our life. Start talking about it a little bit. Starts to look terribly much like what a good percentage of our life is lived like. And he says, I want to disturb that. I can see outside, and I don't like this, and I want to do something about it, but then how should I presume, because I know it myself, and I've been a part of it. I'm a card-carrying member of that world, right? I've known them all already. Known the evenings, the mornings, the afternoons. I've measured out my life in coffee spoons. Know the voices dying with a dying fall beneath the music of a farther room. So how should I presume to disturb the universe when I'm a part of that universe that I'm claiming to want to disturb? Does that argument sound familiar to you? That'll teach you to nod. You're supposed to be rigid and just... And furrow your brow so it looks like you're thinking.
It's like...
That's it. I mean, it would be hypocritical of me to tell you not to do something that I've been doing myself. Now, is that argument something that you might have heard before? In the last 2 or 3 weeks, say. Because I think this poem is very relevant for this particular situation in our lives and in history. How can I presume to say something is wrong that I have done? I can't be hypocritical. Well, you start to think about that and extend that logic. Who else is in a better position to challenge that universe than someone who is guilty of the thing? He knows, and he's in the perfect position. If he continues this way, or if we continue that way, we end up, no one says anything eventually is bad or wrong. How should I presume? What kind of a question is that? How should you presume? It's a good connection. That's a really good connection. I'm not worthy to undo the sandal strap of the person. I mean, it's in a sense, it is related to that kind of humility.
Which is a false kind of...
Well, it's not false, but it's not heavenly.
Yeah.
You know, it's very, very real. But that sense of, when you ask that question, if you really mean it, how do you presume? If you ask that question of yourself, what happens? If you ask a question like, do I dare? What happens to you? If you have any intellectual scruples whatsoever?
You don't get out of bed.
You don't get out of bed. Are certain kinds of questions in themselves overwhelming? Do we really need to know what the question is? I mean, you know, this is what Karen brought up. Do we really need to know what is he's trying to do? Oh, no, it wasn't Karen. Kathy. Do we need to know that? Or is that question, do I dare, the kind that just makes us sterile like that? How should I presume to do anything? I mean, you were reading, okay, I'm John Graber, I'm 31 years old, and I'm reading this poem that is one of the great works of all time. How should I presume to understand this thing? Do I dare allow that poem into me without any defense mechanisms? How should I begin, you know, to ask that question? We are just talking about writing today a little bit. You got that naked page and you're going to say, how shall I begin? And should I presume? Do I dare? And you'll never put a mark on it. If you ask those questions, nothing can happen. They're crippling kinds. I mean, the nature of the question is one that just shatters you.
Just thinking in one of C.S. Lewis's books in the Narnia series, it says, do not dare not to dare.
Do not.
And in a sense, to put it in the negative for me makes me more comfortable. When we say, do I dare?
Yeah.
I say no. Mm-hmm. And when I hear, do not dare not to dare, I go, oh, okay. You know, there's a chance there, you know?
Yeah. Well, in a sense, it not daring is according to our nature. And so we get that part of our nature satisfied in that double dare thing. No, I don't dare. That's right, that's according to my nature, not to dare.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you know, that's the new Adam nature. You want to live, you can't dare not to dare. Mm-hmm. That's right, he moves, that's the turning point. That's a turning point in the poem, that you move toward that, out of this, do I dare, and how should I begin, and so forth. He's lived on the peripheral world, as I brought up to the lifestylers. You've got that beautiful paranoid passage. This is one of the all-time great paranoid passages. I have known the eyes already, known them all. When the eyes that fix you in a formulated phrase. I mean, you're defined. you know, you're fine. You know, Carla Jester is this kind of person. And when I say that, I kill her. I mean, she's dead. In my head, she's dead. I've murdered her. I made a cartoon out of her. The eyes that fix you in a formulated phrase. The knowing looks, you know, oh, I know you. You know, I know, no more surprising. I know where your head's at. I was talking to lifestyle people about that terrible cannibalistic head-hunting quality of knowing where somebody's head's at. You know, if you know where my head's at, you've got it on a platter. You've killed me.
I got things, well, every once in a while, you know, and when you know somebody really well, you can predict, you know, what they're going to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And I've told that people, yeah, I didn't mean to do that. They really can't resent that because you can't kill them.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of things, it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it? Well, this kind of person's always going to respond this kind of way. And then we hear only that part of their reality that fits our prophecy about them. Because our hearing that is a pat on our own back for our own intelligence. Well, we ought to know by the time we're, you know, just, we shouldn't have to be too old before we know what we're doing. You know? When we do that, and yet we find ourselves doing it a lot, don't we? This guy's that kind of, yep, that's exactly, he always comes out. That's always the way he sounds. It's a scary thing. Hopefully we have a, you know, our lifestyle enriched past that point. But I have to bring in lifestyle and relevance of that. No, relevance. Anyway, yeah, it is. Yeah, he lost his head. And in some yeah, head over heels in love with Shalomi. No, Salome. No. That is one of the themes that Behrman picks up in how women come into this particular poem. And they do come in, and they come in bad ways all the way down the line.
Well, one of the things that I was noticing in this with the do I dare thing is also his... What he wants is to be able to see the consequences of his actions.
Okay, what's the connection with Guido in hell?
He does too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's
guy in hell wanted to know ahead of time.
Yeah.
You know, he wanted to know the future. He wanted to be assured that things are going to work out right before he'd commit himself to doing something. When you want that, can you do anything?